This is the June 15 edition of Commodity Week.
Todd Gleason services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Well, welcome to Commodity Week. I am Todd Gleason. Our panelists for the day include Naomi Bloom. She's with TotalFarmMarketing.com out of West Bend, Wisconsin. Brian Stark joined us from the Andersons. He handles facilities in Mansfield and Sydney, Illinois, and Clymers, Indiana. And Mike Zuzlaw is with us as well from GlobalComResearch.com out of Atchison, Kansas. Commodity Week, of course, is a production of Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world. Find us online at willag.org. WILLAG.ORG. Let's begin, as we normally do, by getting a list of topics from each of you that we might want to cover. Just a couple of them from each of you. I'll start with you, Naomi Bloom.
I want to just take a look at short-dated options and how they can be a useful tool to get through these weather markets. It helps to protect new crop coverage or new crop re-ownership if you've made sales recently, and just talk pros and cons with that.
Brian Stark of the Andersons.
I think the biggest thing is what the producer can do to manage his risk in the face of areas that are not forecast to get much precipitation. What does that mean for the market? What are opportunities here with demand potentially being as weak as potentially supply could be if we don't see rain verified?
And Mike Zuzlaw from GlobalComResearch.com.
A surprise to many of us, Todd, the leader on Thursday's trade was not corn and beans. It was the soft red wheat. And be good to talk about that, I think, especially given some of the South American talk that you want to have as well this week.
Well, let's start there. Let's begin with soft red winter wheat. On Thursday, you say it led the market. Why do you think that's the case?
It was up over 5%, Todd, and there wasn't much else up that much in the grain complex. You know, the bean oil gave it a shot. I think that the key trade feature after what I would call a wetter GFS noon model came into play was the European market finally kicked into gear. Not so much the futures, but the cash market is really starting to move. And I think that soft red wheat minus corn spread has been a real nail in the coffin for the corn market to be able to go higher, naturally so, because we've been bringing in wheat imports. And I think the trade's very nervous about corn imports into the United States. But with that over 5% gain in soft red wheat, thanks to the EU cash wheat up about 13%, EU corn in the cash market up about 14%, both since the end of May, I think we're finally starting to see some daylight here and a lack of competition and substitution and just negative fund sentiment centered around EU and the Black Sea and Russia.
Okay, so if I'm hearing you right, and I think this is the case, in South America, of course, short a crop there, soybeans, wheat as well. And then in the Northern Hemisphere, in the current year for this year, the wheat that is in place, hot, dry weather and some concerns in Europe, Black Sea, of course, concerns about whether Ukraine and Russia will be open and can move wheat. And then a short crop here in the United States. So three places geographically around the world that aren't going to be able to provide as much as has been in the past. Is that first correct? And then I want to move on from there.
Yeah, strategies, grains, numbers, cutting the EU cereal crop from 130 to 128.7, I think finally got the market's attention because clients overseas, especially in the Baltic states that I've been in contact with the last 30, 40 days have been kind of screaming at this point. We've got some of the worst drought weather in some of these city states or provinces in the Baltics and in Europe since 2018, which is equivalent to their 2012 drought. So I think that's what we needed and that's what we've gotten so far. And I think also the other element to that is the soft red wheat was reflecting that deep, deep break to the downside in the dollar and that big push up in the crude oil market. So I'd love to hear what Brian and Naomi think, but I really feel as though one of the biggest limiting factors of this market, if we couldn't get some of these other factors to come in and gel, is the idea by many of us that, well, you can take prices higher, but you're just going to import some more into Wilmington bulk and cut the prices or shoot the prices back down.
All right. So I want to stay with you for just a second so that I understand where we're headed. You suggested this take substitution, that would be wheat available to be fed across the whole of the planet, I'm going to assume here, out of play, and that the CME Group's Chicago or soft red winter wheat crop numbers are reflecting the world marketplace. Is that also correct?
Yes, because of the commitment of traders data and how short the managed money funds are. And I think that goes directly to the question, are we going to bring corn in here from Brazil after they get done harvesting their Safrina crop? We don't have to worry about that as much if we have a tight EU crop. And I think that's really a multifaceted thing that could answer a lot of questions. And so I'm still really stuck on watching Europe as one of the major features to where this grain market could or could not go.
Okay, Brian, what are you thinking about this conversation so far? And I know we're going to weave this into the corn market eventually, but what have you heard and what's in your thought processes?
No, I think Mike's points are pretty valid. I think wheat has kind of been one of those commodities that doesn't have a strong demand base where the U.S. has been non-competitive as far as the export perspective. And I think if I'm hearing what Mike's been saying correctly, I think one thing to get wheat is the leader. You start to get away from the narrow relationship, the corn-wheat spread that we've seen over the last month or two that has impacted potentially feed demand, at least in our conversations with feeders and end users, where they can substitute wheat. They're certainly looking at that as a valid substitute, which hurts corn demand to a certain extent. And obviously, we know we have not been competitive with South America on the corn export side for a while now. And I think if wheat has some life to it and there's an outsource of demand for U.S. wheat, you might see that relationship continue to widen, which in essence, in theory, could help some domestic consumption on the corn side, because we know it doesn't appear anytime soon translating kind of going towards your points with Brazil's estimates here from CONAB in their production. We're not going to be competitive, it appears, for a while with South America on the export side of corn. If you just look at their recent estimates of a half a billion increase in production, yet only showing exports of an increase of 50 million roughly, and it looks like domestically, you know, a couple hundred million higher, you know, you're going to have excess and they're going to competing with us on the world side. So I think from a demand standpoint, kind of translates to what I was talking about, wanting to communicate with the producer of how do we manage our new crop risk moving forward when you see, yes, a potential flash drought or turning into a potential problematic period with no rain in the forecast in the Eastern Corn Belt as we approach pollination in the next 3 to 4 weeks. If that pattern doesn't change, yes, we have a supply problem, but we've also got a demand problem where exports are not going to be something that we can rely on to eat into that carryout. If you just look at the overall national yield that's been projected by the government of 181.5, you know, we in theory with the table today have to cut at least 8 bushel to the acre off of that yield with current demand. And some might argue the demand estimates for 23-24 are optimistic given some of these other things we've talked about on the world market. And so if that were to happen, that's a long way to go to make it in a bullish scenario like we see in the old crop table. So I think, you know, it goes back to the old adage and what I like to communicate to producers, especially with this rally, the hardest time to sell is generally the best time to sell. The question is, how do you do that in a sound way to allow flexibility in the market as we go forward? In this instance, we talked about, you know, a solid crop insurance revenue guarantee most producers carry. Knowing today, we don't know if we're going to grow APH. 502 is the floor and 85% level. We weren't going to get aggressive down there because that's where your revenue put kicks in. But I think now that the market has moved higher, you know, this might be an opportunity to layer some floors in place on the new crop, whether that be, you know, a min-max type strategy. What do I mean by that? Buy a put, selling out of the money call to create a fence to allow some upside for the grower to start easing into his risk management, because the producer as a whole is vastly undersold on the new crop side. And I think it's hard to execute, but I think you have to look outside of just the production problem and think about what it's going to take from a production and demand issue to make this table and new crop similar to where we are today to get prices much higher where the growers would like to see them at.
Naomi Bloom, your turn to riff this time around.
You know, you got to just remember also that these markets have really had a nice opportunity to come up for air and take a big breath because we now have a weather market. But of all these points before, yeah, we are still in question about where demand is, where future demand is going to be. We have the threat of a Brazil crop that is huge that can be exported to the world to meet this window of time where the U.S. crop isn't necessarily available between July and harvest. And here's that Brazil crop to save the day. So there's some competition that the United States farmer has that we need to be aware of. Where the market was able to get up to today on this December corn, 575 was such a huge target, was the swing objective higher on the short-term upside-down head and shoulders. It was also the top of the downtrending line that has held us captive for an entire year. And soybeans, similar, the November bean contract today, able to get to 1295. That was the 100-day moving average. $13 is a very, very significant resistance area psychologically and from a technical perspective. And we're all watching these weather markets. We know that we're heading into a three-day weekend. If it does not rain as much as people are hoping from a supply standpoint, we might get another push higher here. But if the rain comes through and if it's a little bit better than what our people are expecting, Monday night's grain trade, when we open Monday night after the three-day weekend, we could see things slide lower like it did in 2013. So really take advantage of the value that's in front of you. We haven't seen some of these prices since March. And a lot of producers said, hey, if we get back up to these levels, I need to get started with cash sales for new crop. And, just really be mindful of what's in front of you because it's up to Mother Nature from here. And that's the bottom line. And we can't control that. But what you can do right now is control your risk management. And that is 100% in your control.
You say get started. How far along do you think they ought to be at this point?
Well, I think a lot of people finally got to 25% today. But I would say over between now and 4th of July, so the next 2 to 3 weeks, I would encourage you, if you're comfortable with how your crop is looking, to get to 50% sold with cash and be thinking about that 24 crop as well.
I want to come back to crop insurance and Brian Stark for just a moment. When you do that, you're making sales, cash sales, below the crop insurance number. You say that's okay. Tell me why.
I think the biggest thing is today we don't know, are we going to outgrow our APH? Are we going to have a shorter crop? And even so, when you look at the price component, we're trying to separate those two. So you have a yield component, you have a guarantee component. Obviously, 85% in an example on an RP policy, your price component of your floor is 502 December futures. Anything below that, growing your APH, you're going to potentially have a claim for the revenue put that you bought back in February, early March. So from our end of the spectrum, we have not been in a hurry here a month or two ago when we were down at those levels. And now that we're above those, even though it's below the spring guarantee price, you still have that deductible, there's opportunity on the table to start taking value off, chips off, especially given what Naomi said. We would agree that the producer is only 15 to 25% sold. And I point back to most instances in areas in 2012, especially if we're talking East Central Illinois into West Central Indiana in my area, where most farmers in that year of the drought of 12 still had half a crop. So I think there's opportunity to at least manage up to those levels, especially as Naomi said, if you feel good about your production. Obviously, that's going to be a little easier west of the Mississippi River than it is east. But there is areas that caught some timely rains, you know, south of 74, stretching from Champaign to Indianapolis here Sunday and then again on Tuesday. Obviously, the northern areas are the areas that are hurt. So I think it comes back to how you feel about your production, but maybe edging out a little bit and getting a little bit uncomfortable making sales, knowing that it might be just a particular area that we're in and not a widespread drought that's going to set the market, you know, another dollar or $1.50 higher.
All right, so let's lay some groundwork, and maybe this is not where you think producers should do things, but cash sales at this point, and then how do they cover them in paper? Or maybe you just want to have them do paper sales, and I'll go around the horn on this one and start, Mike Zuzlow, with you.
Yeah, I would stay focused in the beans at this point, Todd. I know the crop conditions from today and the USDA update put us at 51% in drought. versus 9% a year ago. I think that speaks volumes. I would stay with paper positions. I'm at 100% of insured bushels with paper positions, rolled them down in mid-May, very eager, kind of like Naomi before the three-day weekend, to get those maybe put back up on and closer and more sensitive to the trade price right now. Corn still at 0% on 23, watching the spread very closely. I guess if someone called me today and said, I want to buy a 560 Dease corn put for 40 cents, no problem writing that order. I have a tougher time with the wheat market still being about $1, $1.50 too cheap, in my opinion, from a global perspective, and still wanting to see that corn market find some support off of that. So I'm getting more interested in hedging 23 corn.
Naomi Bloom?
I agree, especially because, again, we're at the high end of this downtrending line that has held us captive for an entire year. The market is overbought heading into this three-day weekend, and it's just, again, up to Mother Nature as far as what transpires from here. So, right, the at-the-money puts for new crop going all the way out to Thanksgiving, right around 40 cents, you can use short-dated options. And, again, it helps to protect new crop prices, but you're not spending time to Thanksgiving. For example, you can buy an August short-dated put, and it gives you time until July 21st, so 35 days. And you're protecting that new crop level and that new crop value, but then the at-the-money goes down to about 30 cents instead of 40 cents. And we'll know for sure, I think, within 35 days what we're dealing with. There's even one where you could buy a July short-dated put, which gets you through until next Friday. So there's a lot of ways to manage the risk, and it's up to each farmer, working with your advisor to understand your particular situation, knowing your rainfall, knowing your basis levels, knowing your risk tolerance. But there are ways to not just stand there like a deer in the headlights. You are able to protect value that is there multiple different ways and leave that upside open in case this thing does take off. So strategy is right in front of you, and just make sure you go ahead and implement it.
And then finally, Brian Starkin, if you could talk about basis, both for fall delivery in January, which were only, about 12 cents apart, I think, at this point, which won't cover storage. So if you could incorporate that and what that tells you about the marketplace.
Yeah, I agree with what Mike and Naomi have said. I'm not a huge cash seller today. I think when I talk about creating floors, there's many different ways to do that. Good ideas suggested by both, and I think whatever fits individually with the producer, it's going to be different for everyone. But I think hedging, buying at the money puts, I prefer selling an out of money call and creating a fence rather than leaving all the upside open and only worrying about the downside, given the fact of the weak demand component and unsure of how far higher we could potentially go yet. There's a lot to be determined, but I think it's a good place to at least establish floors. When you come to basis, I think basis is going to be functioning the size of the crop like it always is. And I think it is very narrow between fall and January. That's kind of why I'm not in the camp of locking in basis today, unless a producer feels like he's going to outproduce his storage. Or if he doesn't have storage, usually we focus on those are the most at-risk bushels, because in a normal crop to above normal crop, a basis tends to get wider over the course of time as space gets absorbed with receipts. So I think there's time to play out. Generally, it happens around pollination. You get a better idea of size of the crop and direction of where basis may go. And I think we've got some time to figure that out. But I certainly wouldn't be attracted to sell the January value today, given the only spread being 12 cents. I think that changes here as we know more about the size of the crop. But I prefer protecting the futures component of the risk right now.
You talked about weak demand a couple of times. We know that when we look at the supply and demand tables, that year over year, USDA really increased the feed and residual number sharply from 52.75 to 56.50. Ethanol was up from about 50 million bushels year over year. Exports also higher from 17.25 or 1.725 billion bushels to 2.1 billion bushels. Are those attainable numbers?
I personally don't think that the export number is, given what we've discussed today with South America's projected size of their crop and the fact that that will eventually, in theory, have to move export-wise out of their country into another source. So That was my point at the beginning of our conversation, that while you can knock off 8 bushel to the acre from the current estimated yield and potentially take the carry out, adjusting nothing else down to 1.5 billion, similar to where the old crop table states, that leaves no room or doesn't even consider potential downward revisions in the demand side of things. Current projected carryout is 2.25 billion for new crop. And so there's a lot of room, and we're dealing with weak demand while ethanol feels like the one steady base as we've seen things continue to improve on the margin side here for a while. The feed side is a function of crop size. I think the government has done that for a long time as far as how they project what feed usage may be in addition to that. So as the crop size comes down, I expect the feed usage to be adjusted lower as well. So I think that component there has me a little concerned about the total upside new crop values will have unless this turns into a more broader drought throughout the central U.S.
Let me put this in a different context for you, Mike Zuzlo, as it relates to demand. 22-23 total use at 13.68 billion bushels in the United States. USDA currently has it for the 23-24, or the crop that's in the ground, at 14.485 billion bushels. That is a huge gap that they expect to be filled. Or a lot of demand that must come. And I think that clearly Brian's concerned that that's demand is not there. Are you?
Yeah, I mean, this is where it goes back to in the short term. If we, because China did what they did this week in loosening their monetary policy, flooding the market, we could get a situation where the dollar wants to make a high and go down sharply. And if it does do that, then I think in the short term, we can actually gain some demand. But all the while, like Brian's talking about, we've got three states below 50% on good to excellent conditions right now in corn. We had zero last year at this time. We've got three on the bubble for next week. And we had a 173.3 yield last year. So the idea is the higher our prices go in corn because of the lower yield, the USDA is going to have to come off that 2.1 billion bushel corn export number and get us probably closer to the 1.725, I think it was, that we came off of this past year, Todd. So you could see as much as a 3% decline in total demand on corn, which would be about 430 million bushels. But then you go back to, okay, how low is our yield? Where's the dollar at? How bad's the EU crop? And so it's a complicated answer. Short term is we could gain some real demand if the dollar went down sharply while we went up because of lower yields. But in the big picture, 2.1's a stretch with a 173 or lower national yield.
Naomi, anything to add? And can you talk a little bit about what conditions are like in Wisconsin, where you are north of Milwaukee?
Yes. I will add regarding the exports, I think what these fellows said is right on. The one thing to also focus on is how China is now going to get the Southern Hemisphere trained to grow more corn, because they realized when our production wasn't fantastic last year, their production wasn't necessarily fantastic last year, and then the European crop, as far as then going into the Ukraine crop and the war, they realize, hey, most of the corn production in the world actually happens in the Northern Hemisphere. In fact, it's over 3/4 of the total global corn production is in the Northern Hemisphere. So they had to incentivize Brazil and South Africa to get the ball rolling and say, hey, we're going to be buying from you. We're going to need you to grow more, because China can't get caught with their pants down again and not have production available year round. So that's going to be a longer term issue that's going to affect the U.S. market. Is going to be continued increased competition from Brazil. And if Argentina's weather gets back on track, we'll see Argentina production pick up, and then keep an eye on South Africa. So just that's longer-term play stuff, so really be watching that. And Wisconsin, as far as our crop here, like a lot of the Midwest, things are hit or miss. So where I live in Fond du Lac, we've had 2 inches of rain in the last week, and we have been really, really lucky. But down by the Madison area where my folks live, they had maybe a half an inch over the past 2 weeks total, and the crop it looks a little different down there. So the corn crop, I was just at my parents' over the weekend, and it is maybe shin high and looks ragged, but it's growing. And then here where I'm at, we are also Shinhai, but we got planted late where I'm at in the eastern part of the state. But rainfall totals are just awfully sporadic, just like they've been for most of the Midwest.
In the Atchison, Kansas area, what do things look like?
Well, I'm sorry to report, Todd, that we are probably looking at the best crop right now that we've had probably in 10 years. And, you know, that's just an unbelievably good crop in northeastern Kansas. And we've had super timely rains. We got planted early on, and we didn't have as much of a freeze or frost threat that a lot of other parts of Kansas did. So it's hard to talk about that with people, you know, west of you and east of you that are really suffering right now. And, you know, people in Rochelle, people in Galesburg saying they're not far from a 2012 scenario a week from now.
And then I know you spend a lot of windshield time between here and Clymers. That's what, a couple hour drive into Indiana. What do things look like for you, Brian?
I think in general, you can see some of the sandier soils are dealing with a struggle of lack of moisture. But for the most part, the crop is holding on fairly well, given the lack of precipitation. I mean, just looking back through, the precipitation we've seen in June in this area, we're about anywhere from 25 to 30% of normal. I think, you know, what I've told growers as we've talked to them, that we generally agronomically subscribe to the fact you can't kill a crop in June. Generally, it's very resistant, roots down. But that also encompasses coming in with some sort of a subsoil moisture profile. And looking back in our average May rainfall, we were only a quarter to 50% of normal too. So that's part of the problem. That's the difference, I think, just coming in with less. But for surprisingly enough, to a point of where the corn hasn't reached, you know, higher than knee high, it's holding on fairly well, has a good green color, and I think can weather the storm. But I think the next couple of weeks are critical. You know, we need to see some continual moisture as we head into July to realize some of the yield potential we had to begin with.
Where do we think the biggest problems are in the United States? Is it eastern Iowa, western Illinois?
I personally think it's draw a line on, I don't know, south of 80 in Illinois, across Indiana, into Michigan and southern Wisconsin. That seems to be the driest pocket. I think it's well documented based on the circle and the map you shared with us before we started our conversation today. That tends to be the driest area that I've seen. And I think eastern Iowa falls within that as well, the eastern half.
I'd have to keep an eye on Missouri. Portions of Missouri still really suffering drought conditions, and there's a lot of livestock in that area. And I know that the hay crop has really suffered under armyworm. So their hay crop is now kind of cut in half in some areas. So keep an eye on Missouri too.
And I'd say south of Lincoln, south of York, Nebraska, some clients have already lost their dry land corn at this point.
How concerned are all three of you about the potential for this crop to really fail at this point? And I don't know what you would consider, let's say 10%. Are we in that range, Mike?
0.9 from 181.5 is 163.3. Not yet, but 3 weeks from now we could be, if we don't change this weather pattern.
Are we down to what, 174?
Yeah, I think we are. I think we're no better than last year at this point. 173.3 was last year's final number. We're probably inching towards that if we lose more of the 50% good to excellent.
Naomi?
Yeah, I don't think you can go much lower than USDA number last year at this point. It's a little too premature to go that far. But even if you use a 173, 174 yield, you've got carryout that's going to be a little bit bigger than what we have right now for old crop. And so you still have the perception of good enough supplies. Yeah, it's snug compared to years ago, but it's also not as dire of a situation. So the weather watching, of course, is absolutely, absolutely critical over the coming couple weeks. And of course, keeping an eye on the entire Northern Hemisphere also. Just like these fellows were saying earlier, it's getting dry in portions of Europe. And of course, keeping an eye on that wheat crop in Russia as well, because they're a global player of a large magnitude.
Larger than last year's ending stocks, but without an adjustment at that point in any of the usage, I take it.
Right, right. So assuming that everything is the same as the June USDA report, and you have the 174 yield, you have ending stocks that are still slightly larger than where we have this old crop ending stock right now, right?
And Brian, where do you assess things?
I don't disagree with what Naomi and Mike have said. I don't think the trade is considering a yield below last year. I would not peg us below last year at this stage of the game. I think we'll be a lot smarter in a couple weeks, one way or the other, on which direction it's headed. But I think that's probably a fair assessment for the time right now.
Let's get a final word from each of you. Mike Zuzla at GlobalComResearch.com out of Atchison, Kansas. A final word, and we haven't talked at all about other things in the outside markets, and maybe you can build some of this in. For instance, the Federal Reserve this week did not make a change in the interest rates.
No, and they did a hands-off approach, but they said they're coming back, and the trade so far is handling that very, very well. I think it's because of China. I think the outside markets look like they're getting a little bit more favorable, the emerging markets, because China looks like they're coming around in their policy, and they're expecting some pretty strong growth because their economy can be driven very quickly by the direct command economy of China. But my final word is very simple. Buckle up, because you've got an electronic Dease corn chart gap down there from when we blasted off this week at 533. And I could see a very good scenario where we come back and fill that, and yet we try and go higher another time. So it's one of those markets where please heed the risk management principles that we all know very well.
Naomi Bloom, your final word?
Yep, keep an eye on what the fund money is doing. They have, haven't been really exiting a lot of positions as of late. I'm curious to see what they ended up doing today, but they're watching what the interest rates are as well. And as those interest rates went higher over the course of the last year, they've been exiting commodities because they can make money easier, simpler somewhere else. And so until they have incentive from either a dramatic news story like a drought, or if we finally see interest rates come down, they might kind of stay away from commodities and kind of keep a neutral position, with the exception, of course, in wheat. They're so short. But I want to keep an eye on the fund money as well, along with the weather markets.
And Brian Stark of the Andersons.
I think the biggest thing I want to leave today, we didn't spend a lot of time talking about old crop corn and soybeans, but I think if you watch this week, we've seen a dramatic collapse in the July SEP, July D spreads in corn, July August soybeans, July no soybeans. That kind of tells a little bit that the market is maybe satisfied domestically. We know we've talked about exports being a drag both on mainly corn, but to a certain extent soybeans as well. And if you don't have the key domestic player and their coverage extends out in the summer, you put yourself at risk for the old crop basis to continue to erode. So if you're still hanging on to old crop bushels, might consider thinking about the best basis in your local marketplace to try and lock that in before some of that cash inverse continues to erode as we get further into the summer.
Commodity Week is a production of Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world. You may find and listen to the whole of the program anytime you'd like from our website at willag.org, willag.org, or search it out as a podcast in your favorite podcast application, or at willag.org. Just hit the podcast tab and you can subscribe to Commodity Week in the Commodity Week player. Our thanks go to our panelists this week, including Brian Stark from Andersons Grain, Mike Zuzla of GlobalComResearch.com, and Naomi Bloom of TotalFarmMarketing.com. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.